Okay, so tonight we are talking about Nehemiah. So grab your Bibles and guess what book of the Bible you need to turn to. Y'all are smart. You know what book of the Bible we learn about Nehemiah in. Nehemiah is a tremendous Bible character. There are so many lessons that we learn from this book. You know, sometimes you might read through the Bible and you might wonder, why does God put certain things in the Bible? You know what? Why are certain stories, why are certain people mentioned in the Bible where, you know, with so many thousands of years of history, how many people do we not know about? How many events do we not know? Are these the only ones that mattered? Well, it couldn't be. Are these the only people that made a difference in the world? Well, they can't be. There have to be more. But God selected certain ones to put in the Bible. Remember what it said about Jesus, the very last verse of the book of John? Remember what it recorded about Jesus in John 21, 25, where it says that this is not everything that Jesus did. If everything that Jesus did was recorded, what couldn't happen? John says the world could not contain all of the books that it would take to write what Jesus. If that's true about a man who lived for 33 years, hello, what about the history of the world? So I say all of that to say, why did God put the book of Nehemiah in the Bible? There's a lot for us to learn from it, a lot of lessons. Those who are involved in leadership, both those who are involved in leadership in the church and really those who are involved in leadership anywhere. There are principles in this book, not just for church leadership. There are principles in this book that help leaders, even in the secular world, to be better leaders if they'll apply the principles that are found here from Nehemiah. So here's the outline that we have been following for each of these events that we're looking at, each of the characters and their building projects that they're involved in. We look at the prelude, meaning what's leading up to this particular event that we're talking about. We talk about the person and their project that is involved in our particular study. And then we look at what was the purpose of this project, what was the pattern that was given, and then what does that have to do with me? What's the personal application that I need to make? So, Nehemiah, where is it in your Bible? Old Testament or New Testament? All right, Old Testament. All right, so if you just looked at your Old Testament books, where does Nehemiah fit? Kind of in the middle. So if you just look at your Old Testament books, the book of Nehemiah is in the middle of them. Here's the problem. That's not where he fits. And you're like, well, that's where he is. He's in the middle of my Old Testament. That's not where he fits. He fits at the end of the Old Testament. Now, that's not where he is in your Bible, but chronologically, where Nehemiah fits is the end of your Old Testament. I wish I had known that when I was a kid. And of course, kids don't understand chronology like more seasoned people do, right? So, you know, but that would have helped me. What are the last three books of the Old Testament? I know we're talking about minor prophets here, so that gets into some cloudy gray area maybe. Last three books of the Old Testament. Remember, you got Malachi, all right? I'll take that one away from you. Last three books. Malachi, back up from Malachi. Zechariah, back up from Zechariah. Haggai. Last three books. All right, you got those three? It's not a spelling test, just asking if you got those three. Okay, hold on to those three for a second. Old Testament, you have the books of Moses, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. How many books of Moses are there? All right. Then you have the books of history. How many books of history are there? There's 12. Okay? Those books of history go from Joshua through Esther. We'll come back to that in a minute, okay? Then you have the books of poetry. How many books of poetry are there? All right, so you got Job through the Song of Solomon are usually called the books of poetry or sometimes called the wisdom literature. After you get through with the books of poetry, then you get to this whole section of prophecy. Usually the prophetic books are divided into the major prophets. How many books are in the major prophets? Five. How many minor prophets are there? 12. You get the pattern here? 5, 12, 5, 5, 12. And when you get that, you've divided up your Old Testament. Okay, now, coming back to the books of history. How many are there? 12 of those. What are the last three books of the book of history? Books of history, the last three books. You think through them. First, Second Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Okay, if you take those three books, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, what were the other three books we talked about a minute ago? The last three books of the Old Testament, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Those six books, they go together. I know they're not together in your Bible. Those six books go together. Why? Okay, because the 12 books of history are telling you about what? It's right in the question. History, good. They're telling you about history. And so as you're reading through the history of the Old Testament, you're reading through the history of the Israelites, it ends, the history ends with Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. The rest of the Old Testament fits chronologically somewhere in the beginning of the Old Testament. And the last three prophets that chronologically fit are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. If you can get that, that will help you just in your reading of the Bible to recognize that when you get to the book of Job, Job is way back in the patriarchal age. That's way back chronologically, way back in the book of Genesis. I'm starting over. And so, all right, that maybe that will help us a little bit tonight because we're going to reference some of these books. So, let's put Nehemiah into its context. Last night we studied about who? Solomon. Solomon, good king or a bad king? Yes, okay. All right, Allison, that was a trick question. All right. Started out good, right? What happened? When you marry the wrong people, why did I use people in the plural? When you marry the wrong person, it will mess you up. When you marry the wrong persons, you really get messed up. And when you marry 700 of them plus 300, you're really messed up. That messed Solomon up. And Solomon's heart was turned away from the Lord by these women. Was it the women? Yes, shake your head. It was the women. What was it about the women that turned his heart away from the Lord? Weren't they good Christian ladies? Didn't they go to church every Sunday and bake casseroles and take it to the potluck dinners? Oh, yeah. They worshiped idols. So when he marries these women who are from foreign countries, and they worship idols. Did they bring their idols with them? Yeah, we'll just bring them right into the home. We'll put them right there on the dresser inside the bedroom. There's my idol. That's my God. Where's your God? I can't see your God, but I can see my God. And with enough time and enough influence, Solomon's heart is turned away from God. Reigns for 40 years, dies. What happens to the kingdom? It's divided. You got the northern kingdom, you've got the southern kingdom. What happens over time with the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes? How many righteous kings did they have up there? Zero. Not a single righteous king. Does that matter? If you don't have a righteous king, I mean, no big deal, right? Nope. So they're taken into captivity by Assyria. Why? Because of their sin, their idolatry, and their rebellion against God, they're taken into captivity. Southern kingdom of Judah. Did they have any righteous kings? Handful, but mostly not. So they lasted a little bit longer. But still, even after they lasted a little bit longer, because of their sin, their idolatry, and their rebellion against God, God allowed them to be taken into captivity. And so God sends Babylon. Do you know what Isaiah the prophet called Babylon? You know what he called Nebuchadnezzar? My servant. Say what? It's a foreign country. He's a pagan. He's not your servant. Well, he's doing God's work. In what way? When God's people have turned to sin and idolatry and rebellion, does God care about that? Does sin have consequences? Yeah. Does sin always have consequences? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're right away. Sometimes they're a little bit later. So God uses Babylon to come along and to, in the year 606 BC, to initially besiege the city, to carry off an initial wave. Do I have this? No, okay, I just have it on the return. Sorry. To carry off an initial group of captives in 606 BC, carries off an initial group of captives to Babylon. Do you know anybody who was included? You know at least four names of individuals that were included in that first wave taken into Babylon. Daniel, and then the Babylonian names we know better, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They're taken in 606 BC. All right? Then there's another wave of them that are taken in 597 BC. And then finally, in about the year 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar comes. He's not king yet, but Nebuchadnezzar comes, destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple, carries off that last wave of captives. And so God's people, Jeremiah prophesied, that God's people are going to be taken into captivity for 70 years. Daniel was in captivity all 70 years. And so were a number of the other folks from 606, okay, that's the beginning of the captivity period, down to the year 536 BC. All right, I know I told you to turn your Bibles to Nehemiah. Back up about 10 pages. Go to the last two verses of 2 Chronicles. When was the last time you read 2 Chronicles? Go to the last two verses. So you're in 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Last two verses. Now it came to pass in the first year of Cyrus, king of who? Persia. Persia? I thought we were talking about Babylon. Yeah, we were. Talking about Babylon, that God's people were in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. Well, what would end their captivity? What would ever cause Babylon to say, oh, we don't want these slaves anymore. They can go home. Well, nothing would cause Babylon to say that. Babylon didn't say that. Well, how did they get to go home? Because the Medes and the Persians came along and conquered Babylon. Now they're in charge, okay? Now they're the big dog. And so you've got the Medes and the Persians come along. They are the world power now. And so Cyrus, king of Persia, is now the man in charge. Like Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon was in charge, here's the new king. So in his first year, this verse says that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. What does that mean? Jeremiah said, you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. That the word of the Lord by Jeremiah might be fulfilled. By the way, do you know where else you read the name Cyrus? About 150 years before he was ever born. It's not Jeremiah, by the way. It's in the other ayah before Jeremiah. It's in Isaiah. You read about Cyrus by name 150 years before he's ever born. That the word of the Lord might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that this king, and I'm using these terms accommodatively, but was he a Christian king? Was he a righteous king? Was he wanting to serve God? No, not at all. God's using him. He's a tool in God's hand. God stirred up his spirit so that he might make a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom, and he put it in writing. And here's what he says. Thus says the king, all of the kingdoms of the earth, the Lord God of heaven has given to who? He's given them to me. I'm the king. And he has commanded me. Wait a minute. I thought you're the king of all the nations. Well, yeah, but I'm not the king of kings. So the Lord, you notice something about the word Lord here? This pagan king is talking about Jehovah, the God of heaven. What is this pagan king? This pagan king knows he's just a tool in the God of heaven's hand. So he says, he has commanded me, the king of all these nations, to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May Jehovah his God be with him and let him go up. All right, so the decree of Cyrus comes in about the year. Do I have it up here? Nope, 536 B.C. Do I have it on the next line? Nope, well, yeah, I do. All right, so 536 B.C., 70 years have passed. So the first wave of, it's interesting to me that there were three waves of captives that were taken into captivity, and then there were three waves that came out of captivity. That helps me because I like symmetry, all right? So three waves come back. First one at the decree of Cyrus in 536 B.C. This is the largest group that comes back. And then you fast forward to the time of Ezra. Notice the time span here between the first wave and the second wave. You've got about 80 years in between these times, okay? When Ezra brings the second group back, a little bit smaller, and then Nehemiah's group in 445 B.C. is even smaller. But you've got these three waves. You've got these three waves of captives that are coming back. Just a point of, we're not going to talk about this, but just a point of reference, because I wanted you to know that Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi fit in the same historical time frame as Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. You read about Haggai and Zechariah in the book of Ezra. And you read about them because when Zerubbabel brought back the first group of captives to Jerusalem, his job was to rebuild the temple. Okay? That's the first order of business. We're going to rebuild the temple. What did we talk about last night? The building of the temple. Were they just wanting to build the temple so that they could have a fit? Remember our lesson from last night. Were they wanting to rebuild the temple just so they could have a physical structure and say, hey, look at our physical structure? No. The temple represented what? The presence of God among his people. Why do they need to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem? So that they can have the presence of God back among them represented in this building. So they start to build the temple in Ezra chapter 3. And the surrounding nations, the people who were already living there and had come in and inhabited the land, the surrounding cities, they were not happy about the rebuilding of the temple. And so they started to oppose them. They started to, you read Ezra chapter 3 and especially Ezra chapter 4, and in Ezra chapter 4, there's a lot of opposition that starts coming against the building of the temple. And so what did God's people do? They quit. That's a good thing to do, right? People don't like what you're doing and serving the Lord. Well, it's just easier not to do it. That's what they did. They stopped building the temple because they were being opposed by people that did not want them to do it. And so for 16 years, the temple site remained idle. I-D-L-E, not the idol that you bow down to, but it remained, they're not doing anything there at the site for 16 years until Ezra chapter 5, Haggai and Zechariah come along and kick them in the pants. Wow. Say, what in the world is your problem? Get building. And so sometime go over and read Haggai and Zechariah and put it in the context of Ezra chapter 5 and the rebuilding of the temple, where they have to come along and get the temple started up again. Okay, so we're not to Nehemiah yet, but that's background leading us up to Nehemiah. So 445 BC, notice that how much time has passed. In 445 BC, the temple has been rebuilt, but the walls around the city have not. Does that matter? Yeah, it matters. And so that's a lot of time that we've spent on that. But that's the prelude. That's the context. When you get to the book of Nehemiah, those are things that are leading up to this event, so that we can kind of put it into its historical context of why this is a big deal. How long have they been back from 536 to 445? 90 years, roughly. They've been back 90 years, and they don't have any walls around their city. That's a big deal. All right, so now turn to the book of Nehemiah. Go back to the book of Nehemiah, I guess. What do we know about Nehemiah? All we know about him is in this book. What do you know about Nehemiah? He's the cupbearer. The last verse of chapter 1, the very last sentence of chapter 1 says he was the king's cupbearer. What does that mean? Does that mean that he was just... Here's what I think we might think it means. I think we might think he was just a lowly servant. And his job as the lowly servant was to sit next to the king, and the king would say, "Taste this. Okay, you're still alive? I'll taste it too." Is that his job? Okay. If you want to look at it in that form, he was the cupbearer. Was his job to protect the king? Yes. But it wasn't some menial, lowly servant responsibility. He was a high officer within the king's court. Do you know any other Jews who went to a foreign land and became high officers in the king's court? We mentioned four of them: Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We know more about Daniel than we do the other ones. Was Daniel a high officer in the Babylonian court? He was. And when Babylon got conquered by the Medes and the Persians, guess what happened with Daniel? He still remained in office. He still had a position of authority, even in those. Now, think about how old he must have been. He was taken into captivity as a teenager. You do the math. It's not hard, right? But here was a seasoned man who did his job in that first kingdom and was used in those next. So come to Nehemiah. Don't think about him as a lowly servant. Think about him as somebody who the king trusted, who was in the king's court, and who had the king's ear. Would that matter in this situation? Yeah, that's going to matter. What else do you know about Nehemiah? Oh, we've already stated it. He's a Jew living in a foreign land. He's not from around here. Okay? Now, he was born there. I don't believe that Nehemiah was more than 70 or 80 years old. So he was likely born in Babylonian captivity. He hadn't been home. He hadn't been to the homeland. But he's a Jew living in a foreign land. But does that mean that he did not believe in God? Did he know about God? Did he know about Jehovah? How did he learn that in Babylon? Babylonians didn't teach that. How did he learn about God growing up in Babylon? His parents? Other Jews? Are we going to reach a point in this nation where people don't believe in God and they're not going to be taught about God anywhere else except for at home and among other Christians? Oh, we've already reached that point, haven't we? Where are our children going to learn about the God of heaven? Where are they going to learn to pray like Nehemiah did? If there's any characteristic of this man, he was a man of prayer. And there's at least 9 times that he just bursts into prayer in this book. Sometimes we're told the words of the prayer. Sometimes we're just told what he prayed about. Sometimes it's just a very short sentence that he prayed. Here is a man who believed in God, and he believed in the power of prayer. In a foreign land where people who didn't believe in God and they served other gods, do we need to be people of prayer? People who trust our God? That even in the midst of bad times, I'm still going to talk to God. I'm still going to trust that He knows what is best. He was a man. You know this story, but look in verse 2. Chapter 1, verse 2. He's in Susa, which is what we're told in verse 1, capital there of Persia. And one of his brothers, Hanani, came from Judah. When you get over to chapter 7, he calls him my brother. I don't know if that's just Jewish brother or if that's my brother. But my brother, he says, comes. Verse 2, and I asked him concerning the Jews who had escaped and who had survived the captivity. And he asked him concerning Jerusalem. And so here's what his brethren tell him in verse 3. The survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in, where are they? They are in Jerusalem. They're the survivors from the captivity. They're back home. But what is their condition? They are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And Nehemiah said, oh, that's so bad. You want something to drink? Let me know when you're leaving. I'll say goodbye. I'll wave to you. But, you know, what's that got to do with me? Is that Nehemiah's response? He hears about what's going on. Verse 4 says he sat down and what? Did this bother him? When was the last time you heard some bad news and you sat down and you wept? He sat down and he wept and he mourned for what? A couple minutes? What does it say? Many days. Who mourns for many days over something like this? What else did he do? Who fasts over? Come on. He's the cupbearer. He has to eat, right? No. Fasting and praying before the God of heaven. What's the point here? Well, the point I just want you to think about is the fact that here was a man who heard about things that were going on. He heard about a need among God's people. Did somebody ask him to do something? We have no indication that anybody asked him to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls. He just said, in David's mind, here's what he says. They've been back there for 90 years, and they haven't done anything. Forget it. I'll go back and take care of this. Do we not need to have that kind of mentality? Instead of waiting around for, so-and-so really needs somebody to go over and visit them. Well, so-and-so, I've heard that she needs some help in the kitchen, that something's going on with her sink, and it's, but, you know, I'm just going to leave it to the deacons. They'll figure it out. If I know there's a need in the church, do I need to be asked to go and do something about it? If I know there's, whatever that is, here's an example of Nehemiah that just said, you know what? That needs to be done. I'm going to go and take care of it. Here is a man who is a tremendous leader. And the thing that comes out in this book, the two characteristics of this man that just stand out. One, he was a man of prayer. And two, he was an exemplary leader. And we're not going to have a lot of time to get into some of these principles about leadership, but that is what comes through from this. And you think, if you have this mentality, he was just a lowly servant in the king's court, at the king's side. You know, what was he? No, here was a man who evidently had been trained to be a leader. I don't think he just all of a sudden became one. He was trained in the art of being a diplomat, being some kind of a leader in the Babylonian Empire, and then eventually in the Persian Empire. And all of a sudden, it's like, okay, He's going to step up and he's going to make a difference here. So he goes back to Jerusalem, okay? And he's going to rebuild the walls. Why? Why is he going to... By the way, how long is he back there? Because when the king asks him, we're not going to look at all of this, but when the king asks him how long he's going to be there, look in chapter 2, verse 6. When he tells the king about the conditions over in Jerusalem, the king said to him, "How long will your journey be and when will you return?" Well, guess what we learn when we get over to chapter 5. How long was he there? 12 years. This isn't a vacation. It's not, hey, you know, you need a couple weeks off to go over to Jerusalem. I'll give you a couple weeks off. He gave him 12 years off. 12 years to go over. So to go over and take care of things in Jerusalem. Now, maybe you're already thinking ahead. How long did it take to rebuild the walls? 52 days. How did 52 days turn into 12 years? You're like, well, Mrs. Nehemiah got over there, and she's like, hey, I kind of... No, no, no. How did 52 days turn into 12 years? Well, because there were more issues there than just the walls. If the walls were in that condition, in rubble, why were they in that condition? Because the people were in that condition. He wasn't just going there to put up the walls. Okay, got the walls done. Check box, we're done. He was going there to help the people of God. And so rebuilding the walls, couple, three purposes here. Rebuilding the walls was to fulfill the restoration purpose. What are the books that go together? Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. You put all of those together, what do they have in common? They all fit in the time period when God's people are being restored back to the promised land, back to Jerusalem, coming out of captivity. They are going there to restore the temple, rebuild it, to restore the law, that's what Ezra's job was, to restore the walls around the city, and to restore them as God's people in God's land. Did that matter? I mean, who cares? Who cares where they live? I mean, couldn't they just keep living over in Persia? Just be the Jews in Persia. Why do you need to be the Jews back in Jerusalem? Why do you need to have the homeland occupied again? Where's the Messiah supposed to be born? In Babylon? In Persia? Is God going to say, well, you know, they're in the wrong place. We'll just change the plan. No, sir. They've got to get back in the land so that all of those prophecies that God made about Jesus could be fulfilled. It's not just about possessing some ground somewhere. It's about fulfilling the plan of God. All right, so they're being restored to this land. They need to rebuild these walls in order for God's people to be protected. And they need to rebuild these walls for God's people to be respected. I want you to see back in chapter 1, verse 3. The people are in great distress and reproach. Look in chapter 2 real quick. Chapter 2, verse 17. Here's what happens in chapter 2. Nehemiah goes back to the land, goes back to Jerusalem. He gets there, and one night he goes out and surveys the damage. He goes out, you know, isn't this a good thing for a leader to do? He doesn't just work on hearsay. What did he know about the walls? They're crumbled. They have not been rebuilt. They're devastated. How did he know that? He'd only heard it. Had he actually seen it himself? No. He hadn't seen it himself. What does a good leader do? I'm going to act upon what faithful people say, but if I can have firsthand knowledge about this, I'm going to have firsthand knowledge. So he goes out and surveys by himself what's happening in among the city walls so that, one, he can know the situation. Two, he can formulate a plan. And that's exactly what he does. He calls the leaders to him after he makes this survey at night. Look in chapter 2, verse 17. Then I said to them, "You see the distress, and in case I don't point this out, we may run out of time later. You see the distress that, what's the pronoun here? We are in. What you talking about, Willis? We are in? Nehemiah, you just got here. Why didn't he say, you see the distress, you, what my basketball coach used to call us, you sorry so-and-sos. You see the distress that you are in? I feel so bad for you. I'm going back to Persia. I had it pretty good over there. Why does he use the word we? It's his people. It's what a good leader does. A good leader doesn't say, boy, y'all are in such bad shape. Feel bad for you. Lucky for you, I'm here. I'm going to fix all your... No. We are in distress. Keep going to verse 17. How Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let who? He didn't say, you lazy bums, get off your... Get up, all of you, and get busy. Let, who is us? That's me too. Let us build the wall of Jerusalem, and I'm getting to the point that we needed to get to, it just took me a while, that we, he includes, so three times in this verse, we, us, we, that we may no longer be a reproach. What does it mean that they were a reproach? When the other nations looked at God's people, no respect. Other nations looked at God's nation. Oh, I feel so bad for them. Look at them. They came and it took them 16 years to finally start building the temple. They haven't rebuilt their walls. There. Little Jerusalem. They're not much of anything, are they? We're a reproach in the eyes of the world. Mm-mm. He says, that's not going to stand. Not if I have anything to do with it. That's not going to stand. And obviously the walls were to protect God's people. Look back up in chapter 2 and verse 10. We're introduced to some villains. Do you like villains? We're introduced to some villains in chapter 2 and verse 10. And we read about these guys all throughout the next several chapters. We read about Sanballat and Tobiah. These are area governors, area officials. So it's not just, you know, grumpy old men. They probably were grumpy, but not just grumpy old men. These are local governing officials. When they heard about the plans, they were deeply disturbed. Think about this. What does it matter to them? They were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek what? The well-being of God's people. Well, who cares if a man came to do this? But what were they thinking? Who cares about these sorry people? Why would this guy come and care about these people? And why would he care about their well-being? Why did Nehemiah need to get these walls rebuilt? To protect the well-being of the people that the villains had no respect for. That's why these walls needed to get rebuilt. We only have about 10 minutes. So let me just put some of this up here. Where I want to get to the personalization side of this. And I want to talk about some lessons that we can learn from this. But just very quickly, when you think about the pattern, and that's the word we're using for all of these building projects. When you think about the pattern, how did they know where the walls were supposed to go? The remnants of those first walls were already there. When they're coming along, they're not making up a new plan. They're not making up a new blueprint. The remnants are already there. We already know where they go because the foundations of those first walls are still here. So we are coming along, and in chapter 3, where is this? In chapter 3, you read the word repair 40 times. So they're coming along, and you're going to read the word rebuild a handful of times in those early chapters. So you read about them rebuilding, and you read about them repairing. Now, there's a lot of work to do, because when you have walls, some of which could have been 30 or 40 feet tall. Is that a big wall? Right up here to the top of this ceiling is somewhere around 24, 25 feet, I think. So you go up another 10 or 15 feet beyond the top of the city. That's a big wall, right? You want to build one of those walls? No, thanks. But when those walls crumble, now you're rebuilding those walls. Some of those walls were at least 8 to 10 feet thick, if not up to 20 or more feet thick. We're not talking about a cement brick wall, you know, with these cement blocks. You know, we're talking about a massive structure. But Babylon had destroyed these walls. But you can still see the footprint of where those walls were. And so now they're coming to rebuild them, which put that in context of, look in chapter 4, verse 6. Put some of that in context, chapter 4, verse 6, where it says, we, notice the pronoun, we built the wall. And the entire wall, which could have been but somewhere around 2 miles probably, maybe a little bit more, was joined together up to what? Half of its height. Now, when you read that, you might think of a half of a wall. So it's like, that's not a very good wall, right? Or maybe it was like Tim the Tool Man's wall, and you could just see, was it Wilson? What's the guy's name? What's the neighbor's name? What was the neighbor's name? Was it Wilson? Okay, I knew that was the friend's name on Castaway, the little volleyball friend was also named, that was Wilson too, right? So, but, you know, Tim the Tool Man Taylor, this is all you saw of his neighbor, right? So when you think about a wall being half height, that might be what you think. But if those walls were 30 or 40 feet tall, what was up to half of its height? Whew, that's a big wall. All right, so why are we talking about this? What's the pattern? The pattern's laid out for them. And they're coming around to rebuild. Chapter 3 is one of my favorite chapters in all the Bible. And it's probably not for most people. Chapter 3 is almost like a genealogy chapter. Are genealogies some of your favorite parts of the Bible? Not generally, right? You're like, oh, I get to make progress today in my Bible reading. Skip? All right, I've already made it half a page. Because we just skip over them. You might look at chapter 3 and you might be like, oh, okay, this is like genealogies because you're just reading name after name after. I love chapter 3 because what you read in chapter 3 is that everybody had a job. Every family was, at least in my estimation, every family was out there and side by side by side. I've got underlined in my Bible in chapter 3 every time it says next to them. Next to them, next to them, next to them. I see a church building project. I see us painting the building over on 36th Street in just a couple hours one Saturday morning. We were all working side by side by side painting. And that's what I see in chapter 3. Side by side by side, they're getting the job done. Isn't that what we need? Sorry? And they got their name in the Bible for doing something good. Right? I mean, some people got their name in the Bible for not so good, but they got their name in the Bible for doing. And what I love in this chapter is when you read about leaders who were involved in the rebuilding. It wasn't just you go do this. No, the leaders were there. When you read in this chapter about families. You read about one man, and it says about one man and his daughters were rebuilding. Hello, not just the guys. One man is out. You read about a couple families that it uses the word another, where they rebuilt another section. Well, why does it say another? Because earlier in the chapter, it had already mentioned them. But now you get later in the chapter, and it says, and they rebuilt another section. What does that tell you? When they got done with their section, it wasn't running off to Dairy Queen and getting some ice cream and sitting back and saying, ha ha, we're done, you're not done. What'd they do? They got done. They went back to Nehemiah and said, what else you got? Give me another section. We're not done yet. What does that tell us? What does chapter 3 tell us about families being involved in the work of the Lord, about people and their children, about leaders not just dictating but getting their hands involved in the work, about saying, give me something else to do, I don't have enough? There's a lot in chapter 3 about them following that pattern and rebuilding. And the story about Nehemiah is restoring those walls back to their original condition. Are we trying today to restore something back to its original condition? If I have this down at the bottom of this list, I think the bottom of this screen sort of matches the bottom of the last screen. What we're trying to do is to restore the church that God originally established in the New Testament. Well, how can we know what that church looked like? How can we know what that church, where that church was supposed to be and what it's supposed to be doing? Same way those people in Nehemiah's day knew where to build the walls. It was already there. You just put it back where it was. How do we know what the church is supposed to be like today? It's right here in the New Testament. Just put it back where it was. Go back and teach what they taught. Go back and practice what they did. And guess what? You will restore that church. But just for a couple minutes, I've got 3.5 minutes. Let me talk about the things on the top of this list. How do great things happen among God's people? Well, great things happen when God's people have a mind to work. And that's right here. Look in chapter 4. We didn't finish chapter 4 in verse 6. But they finished the wall up to half its height. How did they do that? Because the people had a mind to work. What do we need today? We need people who have a mind to work, all right? But that's not enough. Can you have a mind to work but still not work? Yep, all right. So it's not just that they had a mind to work. It is that they set their hands to do the work. Look over in chapter 2, verse 18. You got to go with me quick because I want to make these points. Chapter 2, verse 18. This is in the discussion that Nehemiah is having with the leaders after he surveyed the damage. He said, I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good to me. And we'll come back to that in a minute. I told them also of the king's words. And so they said, after I talked to them, what did the people say? Sorry, Nehemiah, we've been here 90 years. We haven't done it yet because it hasn't worked. Nope, we've tried that. Nope, that won't work. We've tried that. Nope, that won't work. We've tried that. Do you know any people like that? It's not what they said. They said exactly what Nehemiah said. Let us rise up and build. Did they just have a mind to work, according to verse 18? Then they set their hands to this good work. Wasn't just that they had a mind to work. Once they had a mind to work, they put their hands to do the work, and they could rebuild those walls in 52 days. Some people look at that and say, there's no way, that's an exaggeration. And they want to make all sorts of excuses for chapter 6 and verse 15 is where it tells us they rebuilt the walls to their full height in 52 days. And people have read that verse for years and they say, there's no way that happened. Why not? The Bible says that it happened. Well, because of this and this. Wait a minute. No. Here's how it happened. Go back to chapter 2 and verse 18. I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me. They hadn't even started rebuilding yet. And Nehemiah is already telling them, my God has been good to me. And so he's going to continue to be good to me. Go to chapter 6. I've got a lot of other verses up here on this, but go to chapter 6 real quick. Verse 15 is where they rebuilt the walls in 52 days. Verse 16, it happened when when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes. Why? Do you have the word for in your Bible? Why? Because they perceived that this work was done by our God. And when you read these other verses from chapter 2 that I've got up here, from chapter 2 and verse 18, and I just read to you the last verse in this sequence, if you go through and read all of those verses, guess what Nehemiah keeps saying? God's got this. God's got this. God's got this. And when we trust God enough to say, I don't know how this is going to happen. I don't know how this is going to work, but we're going to step out on faith and we're going to get the job done because God's got this. What limits are there that we cannot reach? And that's individually as Christians. That's families as Christians. That's the whole church. Great things happen when God's people put their mind to work, when they put their hands to work, and when they trust the providence of God to be working right there with them and for them. Not that the work is ours, but that it's His, and that He'll make sure that His work gets done. I wish we had time to talk about them not compromising. They got all sorts of flack, all sorts of opposition. Those villains kept coming and trying to tear them down and get them to stop. They never stopped. They tried to trick them. They lied to them. They said, hey, just take a break for a little while. Are people saying to us, hey, just take a break? They didn't compromise one iota from what God gave them to do. Great things happen when we don't compromise. Great things happen when we've got great leaders and great followers. A lot of good stuff in the book of Nehemiah. Go home and read it and enjoy it. Thank you all for your good attention tonight.